and welcome to the final episode of the Souls Footnotes Careers Podcast Series. I'm Nick Leavenworth.
And I'm Tamsin Bellew.
And today we have a very special episode coming because I will be sitting down with the Dean and Head of Sydney Law School, Simon Bronnett. And I know we've talked a lot about that big scary word, clerkships, on these last two episodes. So luckily this one is about everything but that. Tamsin is our resident non-clerkship interested host. How are you feeling?
I'm really excited. Professor Bronnett has been in academia for such a long time. And as someone who doesn't want to go down the whole commercial corporate law path, I'm really excited to hear about, you know, emerging areas of law and things that you wouldn't necessarily hear about as much in law school.
Yeah, and he does touch on everything. I had the pleasure of sitting down with him for about an hour and just hearing him talk. And the guy loves to riff. He's got a wealth of knowledge through his 32 years of working in academia, from ANU in Canberra up to Queensland and then down here to Sydney. And he speaks a lot about what you can be focusing on, not just as a JD or a LLB4, but he speaks a lot about what LLB1s and LLB2s when you're young in these formative years and how to make the most of your time at uni and how to find your passion in the area of law that you will end up working in. It's a great, great interview, so I recommend listening to all of it. And with that being said, here's my interview with Simon Bronnett. I'd now like to welcome on a very special guest to the Souls Footnotes podcast, a man whose three-decade career in academia has brought him all over Australia, seen him rise from a senior tutor at ANU to the head and dean of Sydney Law School, I believe about to celebrate your third anniversary.
That's correct.
It is Simon Bronnett. Simon, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. So look, first I'd like to acknowledge we're here on Gadigal country, and I want to pay respects to elders past and present. I think it's really important as a law school that has endorsed the Uluru Statement of the Heart that we do more to address those issues around reconciliation with First Nations people, and this law school is in a strong position to lead in this area, particularly for the benefit of our staff and students, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. So, I just want to acknowledge it's a beautiful sunny day here in Gadigal country. And, I'm very, very blessed to be turning 3 years in office very shortly, which, of course, has been a very unusual 3 years with the pandemic. So it's nice to meet Nick. I know we've engaged on Zoom before, so it's particularly lovely to meet you in person.
Yeah, great to be here in person on Gadigal land, like you said, on a beautiful sunny day. It's not like we have many of these days. So before we get into it, what's your favorite place to get coffee on campus here?
Forum.
Forum?
Yeah, Forum in the Michael Spence building. I have to say, there's a whole range of reasons why I favor Forum. It's run by European Italians, and they know what they're doing. But also, I have to say, when the pandemic hit, there was a small core of staff that would come in every day, academic staff and students who had to come in for their experiments and their research, and that coffee shop didn't close.
So you received your LLB at Bristol in 1988, then your LLM at Cambridge in 89. Then you began your career in academia, like I said, three decades plus, in 1990. What made you go into academia? Was that always your plan?
No. So I think it's probably Simon Bronnett, born in London in 1966 to a family that were not from a professional background. No one had been to university. In fact, no one had gone beyond 16 at school. So I'm the first in my family not to be a tailor. So I come from a East End Jewish family of tailors. Law was never in the family lexicon. Neither was education, really. I mean, everyone was committed to learning a trade. I have sisters. They went into jewellery, hairdressing, a whole range of things. So I was an oddity. I had the benefit of going through a public education system, local primary and local grammar school. It gave me a pathway at 16 to get into a selective school, I think what you'd call here a selective school, and that really set me on the path for university at a time when only 5% of people leaving school would go to university in the UK. So I felt very privileged. But never considered Oxford or Cambridge at that time as an undergraduate because I had certain stereotypes about university and I had no one to guide me, so I didn't apply and I went to Bristol and I enjoyed that experience. It rained a lot. Bristol is one of those cities where it's always raining. So when Australians complain about the rain, I always kind of laugh. I think I had 3 years where it didn't stop raining.
Yeah, I'm a California boy myself, so I'm exactly the opposite. Yeah. This is the most rain I've ever seen in my life, being in Sydney.
But look, what was critical for me all along was teachers who saw some potential. It wasn't necessarily evident right at the beginning in primary school, but people who said, look, you've got the opportunity to go further. You know, have you considered going on to A-levels, which is kind of HSC, and that took me to the next school. And, you know, from there to university, teachers were very influential. And even the decision to go to Cambridge was a tutor who pulled me aside. He was only 25 and he'd just come back from, started at Bristol, but had done his LLM at Cambridge. And he was a working class boy from north of England. So I said, oh, I don't think I'd fit in. And he said, oh, no, you'll, it's a really international program. You'll have a great time. So again, the influence there of teachers all along. So I finished. I finished university. I didn't go straight to academia. Far from it. I was very intimidated by public speaking. Something people don't believe today. Because I have to do it a lot, but didn't do any mooting. I was very nervous about getting up, even asking a question in class. So quite shy, I think. So look, I wasn't inevitable. I went to the Law Commission. I started my career as a researcher after Cambridge in the criminal law team, and I did that for 2 years. I had articles lined up to do my start graduate trainee program as a solicitor in one of the big firms. Mm-hmm. And in those days, there were so many opportunities to work in the city. You were kind of beating them off if you went to a good law school, and Bristol and Cambridge kind of would set you up for that. But look, I was really interested in research, not criminal law. I didn't have a passion for criminal law at all, but that's the team they stuck me in, and in a way that determined my interests partly. But I remained very interested in legal history and comparative law and legal history, comparative legal history, those kind of courses that I did at Cambridge. I really enjoyed comparative law. So I kind of brought those two together in the course of the next 32 years that I've been in Australia. So very privileged to have started in Canberra at ANU. I had 19 and a half years, I think it was in total. I really cut my teeth with some outstanding legal scholars, and they taught me a lot about legal research and teaching.
Yeah, and what was it about Australia? Why Canberra?
Well, like all things, you could say, oh, because, universities are ranked so highly and they withdraw you accordingly. But that wasn't really the truth. The truth would have been much more prosaic. I hadn't taken a gap year. The concept of a gap year for my family would have been considered to be totally indulgent and ridiculous. So I just I wanted to have a bit of a break, and I saw a job advertised in the Times and the Guardian for interviews in London for a position at the ANU. And so I met the dean, and he offered me a senior tutorship, and the rest is kind of history. So I I ended a relationship in London, and a bit of a lost soul at the age of 24. I thought travel. Young man broadens the horizons, and that's what I did. And I actually arrived on January 15th, I think it was, 1991.
Yeah. And since then, you've been all over Australia, senior tutor, like I said, to the head and dean of Sydney Law School. Mm. You've definitely seen countless students come and go, succeed in law. What is maybe a common thread that you've seen in the students that have been the most successful?
Well, it's interesting. Not always it's who you think will be most successful, or at least, let's say, also have the most interesting and impactful careers. We put a great emphasis, of course, as you would expect, on academic performance, and, the people who get the prizes and the medals, and I don't want for a minute to suggest people don't strive for those. But in a place like this, the cohort generally is so impressive. And sometimes they feel they're not as good as others because, you know, they're in the, you know, they're in the bottom half of the class, or they're not in the in the top 10%. And I feel that's it's a very harsh judgment on themselves. And they should really look to some of the amazing careers that people pursue. And, you know, I've seen students who've been passionate about research, they weren't very good at exams. And, you know, as a result, they didn't end up with first class, second class honours even. But they were passionate about their research, and they took that further and published their research paper that they did in their dissertation unit. And that led them to go on to do a master's. And from that, that led them to a policy career. And they're now an attorney general's. And if you would have said, oh, well, that person was definitely in the bottom half of their honours cohort, yet now is at the heart of the attorney general's department shaping policy. So I think people sometimes put too much store on high academic achievement. You know, that sounds like don't bother, you know, you can make it however you like. And I think having, what's the word? I mean, being academically successful is a necessary but not sufficient condition for success in life and in the professions. And I've seen many, sometimes some of the best students intellectually actually not thrive in the next stage of their lives for a whole range of reasons. So my advice is, and as someone who was in the top 10 to 15% of their class always, never got a prize at law school, but my first article got a prize. You know, I never got a prize. I always go to prize giving and I always think, oh, that's interesting, as I congratulate everyone who comes across. I never got a prize at law school. I was good, but not good enough. You know, there are so many great people that go on to do amazing things that are not prize winners. But maybe, you know, that gives them a different set of motivations to continue to strive. What I would say is discipline and determination is really important through life. And sometimes it's getting up in the morning, getting into the work, and putting in the hard yards that actually counts most. So that's the kind of profile of students I've seen succeed. And now those students are academics all over the world. Some of them are chair professors at NUS, at Oxford, Cambridge, you know, all the London universities all spread around, you know. And some of them still feel they have talk about the imposter syndrome, you know, having, don't ever look at my performance in criminal law. I got a pass in my first year in criminal law, and yet I write a leading textbook in it now. And, you know, I think the point is there's always redemption in life. And I always used to joke to my students that when I shared that story with them that, you know, my performance was so average in my first year, I was condemned to repeat the course every year as a teacher of criminal law.
That's funny. Mm. Yeah, I know one thing we stress a lot in this podcast is that everyone's path is different. So don't be afraid that you're not living up to the standards of the people that may be getting top of the class, might be getting all the awards. So that is great to hear. And this isn't just advice that applies to third year JDs or fifth year LLBs. This stuff is all useful for LLB1s and JD1s. So when you come in, I can speak from experience, the career in law, it can seem a little daunting, overwhelming, that there's just so much to know and so little time to know it. What can LLB1s and JD1s do when they're coming into law school, while they think they don't have to think about their careers? What can they be doing now to get a foot ahead?
Well, look, I think everyone seems to be in a real rush and to get through their degree as quickly as possible. And in a way, I understand the pressures around them. They could be personal, professional, and financial. And we don't necessarily, as an institution, make it easy to take the path less well-traveled in terms of exchanges. As I was walking here, I was seeing the you know, electronic notice board advertising exchanges. And I know a lot of students do those in their other degree. I think it's so incredibly important to take up those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to spend a semester. And I look at students who've really grown and thrived. They've pretty much all taken a semester somewhere else in Europe, in North America, in Asia, and it's changed their lives. So, look, I would encourage travel and study overseas. And be open to those kind of opportunities. They're not without cost, and I acknowledge that. But the university has, you know, ways in which it can support it. So, and I'm very keen to prioritise as much support for students. We've got students who are doing internships in the International Criminal Court, in the ICJ, and one of my priorities has been making as many bursaries and scholarships available to support that, because it's expensive to live in The Hague for 6 months. But these are the kind of opportunities that I think are important. So throwing yourself into those opportunities that a lot of people say, don't do that, it'll slow you up, it's a race. Well, I think you've talked to anyone in the law firms, they're having a real challenge holding on to their staff at the moment. So the market is tight for lawyers, which makes it actually very good for students. If any group of students have the opportunity and the freedom to consider paths less well-travelled, it's this group. So look, I, you know, great opportunities to work in you know, do internships, to work in community justice centres, not just for a weekend or two, but to spend a couple of months on country, working on, if you haven't been to Western Australia, you know, getting out to places you've not seen and doing that during a break. I think law firms look really positively on that now. And if I think of the students that I do know, it's not considered a negative, mm-hmm. Because these law firms are very committed to their own reconciliation action plans. And, you know, they're, you know, very mindful of the corporate social responsibility they have. Yeah. So I think having future lawyers that are not just focused on the narrow set of professional corporate law, commercial law interests is something that they value.
Yeah, and let's talk about those commercial and corporate interests. It wouldn't be a careers podcast unless we at least mention clerkships. Obviously, being at such a world-renowned school, such a presence in the Australian market, which means deep ties with the leading firms. Because of that, we see the clerkship application process it's advertised quite a bit. It's something that I've seen from the first day I started. We even mentioned it in my orientation on day one. Do you think that other areas of law aren't advertised as much? And what are some places that you think students should look to if they're maybe not fascinated by the clerkship idea?
Well, I mean, you're quite right. As we walk into this building and go into the library, it's, you know, Herbert Smith Freehills, mm-hmm. Rooms that are named after law firms, lecture theatres named after law firms. And you look around the corridors and you see people who are leaders of the profession. The interesting thing is, I think the Sydney Law degree does cultivate leaders, but not just in law. I mean, a quite significant number of political and corporate careers. In fact, after 10 years, we can say very few of our leading corporate lawyers are still practicing as they did in the firm that they started. That idea of, you know, one firm, one career is definitely not the future. There's a lot more mobility lateral and across into different roles. Office of General Counsel, I think a lot of people like the idea of getting beyond just dealing with the kind of pointy end of transactional work or litigation and into more strategic, high-level business decision-making. So OGCs, Offices of General Counsel, become, you know, a very accepted pathway. So we don't talk about that much. We're doing our best, obviously, ourselves to do careers panels that open up that full range. Law reform, again, a fantastic way of apprenticing in legal research, which is good if you are thinking about the bar or even an academic career, as in my case. Fantastic opportunity to do that. And we have local and national law reform commissions. So I think corporate law firms today are quite different from they were, 30 years ago when I had my articles, offer of articles from seven top London firms. And I think that is so with students today. They're not going to have one career, they're going to have multiple careers. What that is really up to the students themselves to think about what they're passionate in. And that would be my advice, really, is, people have, even if they're JD students, they have a first degree, they may be doing law on the back of science or international relations, you know, the opportunity to draw down on your expertise in your other degree as well and find that sweet spot of synergy is really fantastic. And, you know, that we sharpen this very clear bifurcation as either you're going to be doing corporate transactional work and commercial work, or you're going to be working in the not-for-profit community justice area. And there's a whole range of careers within that. And working in the integrity space, you know, we may get a national integrity commission. I've got students that have, you know, worked in the ACCC, working with regulators. Lawyers are highly valued not only for their ability to advise on the law, but also to manage the regulation and the very important public education roles of those regulatory agencies. So, and then that kind of sets them on a path, you know, a regulatory career, and then they'll end up, you know, chairing these commissions. So I think these are not careers that we talk about, and we certainly never talk about academic careers. It's one of the great mysteries. Well, how do you become an academic? Well, they're not ever law students. They just kind of grow in a petri dish somewhere in a laboratory, and I think that's quite interesting. So a lot of my colleagues start, like most students do, they do their traineeships, they qualify, not all of them, but then they embark on a kind of a PhD program. Lots of fantastic opportunities there to go overseas and study. I would always encourage you not to continue to study in the same institution. I shouldn't say that, because of course we want all our students to be enrolled in Sydney Law School, mm-hmm. and keep enrolling. But honestly, I think come back. But you know, the opportunities to study internationally and go where the scholarships take you. I think again, there's another perception that, oh, it's not worth doing it unless you go to Oxbridge or the Ivy League. And again, there are some fantastic law schools around in the UK, where, you know, find out who are the exciting scholars doing work in the area that you're interested in and see what opportunities exist there. We tend to narrow our focus even for academic careers that, oh, you know, the name will open doors, and maybe for some people, but, you know, in academia, people are more impressed by who you're working with and where you're publishing and what you're doing, not the brand of the degree that you obtained. Well, anyway, that's my view.
Yeah.
And I sit on a lot of recruitment recruitment panels.
Well, that's good to know. Mm. So 1990 is when you started your career. I'm sure since then you've seen a lot of areas of law really just boom, grow from basically out of nothing. I know a big one is environmental law, which has really taken off in the last few decades. In America, a big one is cannabis law, which is actually now being taught in some of the Colorado law schools. What are some areas of law that you think are going to be booming in the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, interesting. I taught drug law and policy at ANU in the 1990s. So very little that is new, apparently, is really new. And the same with technology. When I worked at the Law Commission in 1988, we did the first project on computer misuse, as hacking was described at the time. And even though essentially the personal PC didn't exist, there was still increasing concerns about how law regulates technology. So in the that led to the first hacking offence pretty much anywhere in the world. That set me on a pathway to be interested in technology and law, and particularly cybercrime, mm-hmm. again, a term that was only in science fiction, but now we have a Cybercrime Act. So I'm always very interested in the way each generation thinks in the AI discussion. AI and law is new. Well, it's not, actually. People have been talking about it and discussing it and writing about it for three decades. It seems like each generation is determined to find it again and raise the same sets of issues, albeit with the advances of technology catching up. So algorithmic bias and risk is there. But look, technology is a huge enabler, and it's also a very powerful tool of embedding and legitimating discrimination and disadvantage. We see that with things like the RoboDebt scandal. I actually don't think they're terribly exotic topics these days. I think they should be integrated pretty much into every compulsory course. Technology aspects are there across every area. So I think that's the stage of maturity we have. I think we just expect our students to be, let's call it tech savvy in the broadest sense, to understand the issues that technology throws up. Does our curriculum do justice to it yet? Oh, well, we're doing some review of our curriculum over the next year and a half. As a group of teachers and students, I think we're very keen to find out what are the, I'm not going to say hot topics, what are the core elements of a legal education that we feel will stand the test of time. I am a traditionalist, though. I think certain core skills will always stand out. Your ability to write and write well, mm-hmm. your ability to research effectively, to be able to see the wood from the trees, you know, that ability to distinguish relevant from irrelevant material, the ability to apply it under a bit of time pressure. I've mentioned that horrible word, exams.
Yeah.
They're actually, in my view, core competences. So I'm not in favour of replacing everything with, you know, projects that are multimedia. I think those skills are really important. And I've always embraced technology. In fact, I devised with my colleagues in Canada in 1995 the first web-based course anywhere, as far as we can tell, in the world. And we taught it over trans-Pacifically. We linked up UBC and UVic in Canada with ANU and Macquarie here in Sydney, and we taught an amazing colonial legal history course, which was multimedia. And that course was a pioneer. So I'm all in favour of technology, but it's an enabler. In that case, it was an enabler of allowing a more multimedia experience. It was funded by the Canadian government, and it allowed students to be linked up in real time across vast distances. That was in the mid-90s. So to see Zoom now as, you know, ubiquitous to me is, well, it's COVID drove it, but, you know, in some senses, it's been going on for a long time. This ability to, and I see that as a fantastic opportunity for rethinking ways of connecting, connection, not what I see often in Zoom, which is actually disconnection, where students and their teachers are in a mutual state of technological anomie, I'd call it. They're like dissociation.
Yeah.
Students got their screens off. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all do it. And one of the reasons I'm really keen to see students back in the room is to build that social connection with their teachers, with each other, and also to have all of those fantastic conversations at the margins, you know, after a lecture, where you come in and you talk to your colleagues, you go off in a bit of a study group to unpack something, or you are able to doorstep the lecturer and have a fantastic natural conversation and they get to know you. Isn't that the, those are the highlights, I think, of a legal education. And that's not going to happen on Zoom, let's be honest. So in some senses, it's, you know, I think some of the senses are we'll never get people back in the room together. I mean, we could have done this over Zoom.
Yeah.
But it would be a very different kind of conversation.
No, it wouldn't have been the same.
It wouldn't have been the same. That's right. Yeah. So look, I'm really excited about, well, excited about getting to know my students in person. Mm-hmm. And I hope they're equally excited.
Well, I'm definitely excited. I'm glad we had the ability to sit down and do this. I know over Zoom was discussed, but I've done interviews over Zoom before. It's just you definitely do miss an element of the connection, the in-person things that you just don't get. So I obviously came from the United States to Australia. You came from the UK to Australia. You talked just now about the connectivity that technology can bring. How do you think it has affected the connection from law firms in different countries? And how do you think it's opened doors for Australian students to practice abroad?
Well, look, Australians are an itinerant nation in the sense that young Australians rites of passage in a way that maybe the Americans with junior college could compare. But the Australians tend to go for 3 to 5 years. So they graduate and they pretty much often have a flight ticket, a visa and a backpack and off they go. And look, many, many do it. And they head to America. And the great thing about our degree is it's pretty straightforward. I sign off on the certificates so they can go sit the Washington bar exam or the New York bar exam. And pretty much, you know, I've never known one of our students to fail. Mm-hmm. One thing you can say about Boot Camp Sydney Law School is that you know how to prepare for examinations. And a lot of law schools don't do that. And particularly the JD in America can be a very, it can be a very different exercise depending on where you go. So it's not surprising that our students blitz the bar exams around the world. They're very highly regarded. So I've got a former student who's working for James Day in Manhattan. He's been doing it for a couple of years. He's about to take up a PhD at in the UK. And look, the ability for him to work in comes from a small Queensland regional town. He returned and basically worked as an attorney with Jones Day from Grafton in New South Wales because he wanted to be close to his mother.
Yeah.
He's a good son and look after her. And he could do that. So there was that kind of flexibility that technology enables. Whether that will persist, that degree of real flexibility that people can work anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of prognosis that, you know, people are going to be able to live their lifestyle first, work will fit in around it. I'm not convinced that all, particularly corporate law firms will want that. If it is, it's going to be negotiated very carefully. Because there's a lot of things that go on in the office in terms of mentoring, interactions. Technology is not always an efficient way of transacting business. You know, I think having sometimes a face-to-face conversation where you can read people's emotions and motives much more effectively is lost on Zoom. And there's now evidence that we know that is the case. There's a lack of focus, a lack of attention. And we read, I can tell whether this interview is going well by looking at your body language. It's much harder on Zoom to see how things are going. For example, I can tell I'm giving answers that are way too long and you're trying to wind me up.
No, but you're doing great. You're doing great.
Yeah. But look, I think as the Chief Justice said in his swearing in, and it was a controversial comment that he made. He said, you know, he's looking forward to bringing the people back into the courtroom and, you know, and being more judicious in the use of technology in the courtroom. A lot of people said, hey, we're all in favour in the profession of flexibility, and particularly if you have family responsibilities and, you know, but I think the point that he was making is that there is something that's lost if you never, in a sense, engage in that, you know, that camaraderie and the, you know, the social interaction, which is not always social, it's often professional, in the margins, in the liminal spaces around work, that I think are lost. And that's very important for teamwork. And so I think one of the things about teams is that their ability to withstand conflict within them. And if you're disconnected and the only time you catch up with people are through Zoom, then when things go wrong, well, we all retreat to our Zoom positions, and I think it's it'd be interesting to do some work down the track on the unintended effects of Zoom, which maybe there'd be more conflict in the workplace.
Yeah, definitely. So let's bring it back to the University of Sydney. There's tons of resources. I think I spoke earlier about how it can be overwhelming how many resources there are. I know we spoke a little bit off air about how when I arrived to when I got here, I've learned about countless things that I can take advantage of, but also learned of countless things that I should have been taking more advantage of. What are some things both through the university and outside the university that you think students should be using as they decide their legal career?
Well, you know, there are certain untapped things that students could look at. So let's look at it in those terms. Sales, great fan. What a fantastic law student society. And I'm not saying that because you're obviously here as a sole person. But honestly, I've worked in other law schools and they have student bodies that have, you know, more or less organized. This has got to be I think it is the oldest law student society. Melbourne will probably argue about that, but, you know, it'll be within the space of a few months. But look, it has such an amazing advocacy role, welfare focus. It's a seriously scholarly association, but it's also engaged in fun and looking after that aspect of it too. So I think, and on the careers front, you know, the university generally has been in a position where it could step back because our student association is so proactive and the firms, many of the hiring partners have been sales people, so they know and support and fund the amazing range of activities. And the same in other disciplines, even in the professional schools. So we're very fortunate. What I would say in relation to what students could do, be involved in sales, is great. And there's always, you can find something in sales to do because it's a big organization. But things that you can do outside of that is the law school as a community of scholars and teachers and researchers has an enormous range of amazing talks and conferences and events and podcasts And I'm not sure students' vision is very limited to Sales. They see the law school in a way through the lens of, mm-hmm. of the Sales portal. But if you just approach the law school as a member of the general public, right?
Yeah.
Putting that aside, you'll see there's amazing conferences that you can attend. And, you know, I have to say, you are welcome. If it says public, it doesn't mean no students need attend. It's actually public. And I would just encourage you to see if there's something going on, an amazing array of stuff that's going on all the time with leading scholars in discussion with others. For example, tonight, Teela Reid will be giving a presentation on reconciliation for the Sydney Ideas, mm-hmm. which is an amazing public-focused event. Teela Reid is our First Nations practitioner in residence, talking about the statement of the heart, what we as White Australia needs to do to reckon with our colonial and our more recent past and ongoing challenges. It's inspiring. And it's just a click away. It's also online. And what I would hazard to say is that people will be zooming in from all over, but probably not our students. And I feel that's a bit of a shame. I think there's too much of a gulf, in a way, between the students and the academics in relation to that. We have so much great learning here to share, not just in the classroom, beyond it. Mm-hmm. And I think understanding that we're not just teachers, we're scholars and researchers and public advocates for law and justice is an important thing that students need to comprehend. I'll kind of end it with a quote of Julius Stone, who was our first chair professor in legal theory, Chalice Professor of Legal Theory, and one of the great socio-legal theorists in the post-war period. And he said in relation to how do you define a law school was the question, and he said, law school worth its salt is, and deserving of that name, is a group of scholars, some more advanced in their learning and some less advanced, coming together to discuss what is known and what is not known about the law. And I think that if I can play part of a role in creating a forum like that as a law school, not that we're here to instruct you in the ways of law, but we can share our learning around law, I think that is a really exciting and, it's an aspiration. And, I think it starts with Sales. It starts with the faculty reaching out more to engage our students through wrapping them into internships and doing those kind of things. So I'm really excited about now we're back on campus, now we're back in the law school, the amazing things that we can do together.
Yeah, and just to wrap up, only a couple more questions for you. Tell me about your research assistants. I've always thought that that's one of the more rewarding roles that a law student can have. And you can obviously go on to practice a whole array of things after being a research assistant. What are some of the things that you've personally seen from your research assistants? What are some of the things that they've gone on to do?
Well, most of them have gone on to academic careers. Not all of them. Some have gone on to very, very successful government and usually after a period of postgraduate study. Mm-hmm. So some of them start academic careers and then, you know, after 10 years they think, oh, look, I'll go to the bar, and some of them are barristers now, mm-hmm. and probably will be judges. So there's, you know, it does tend to incline people towards a more policy or governmental or academic role. But just generally, I have to say, depending on the area, of course, getting the benefit of honing your research skills and close feedback from, because you know, your supervisor will tell you when you're not doing things right, mm. and you'll learn quick.
Yeah.
Is much better than essentially getting the annotations on your essay as they're delivered through SpeedGrader or however you get your feedback. I do think that it's a great job. It's interestingly, you know, there are processes by which opportunities are advertised. They're made available. Students can register their interest. But you know, significantly over the course of my 30 years, it's students coming up and saying, knock, 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 on the door. I'm really interested in the work that you're doing in this. you know, is there any scope for me doing some research with you on this? They typically, students have finished, well, they have to finish your course with you because there'd be complex conflict of interest.
Yeah.
But it's not always the student that tops the class, not the person that gets the prize. But they genuinely have a passion, and those relationships, and if you look at all of my articles and books, the debt that's to research assistants is huge, because they become an extension of you and a critical friend. And what I also take very seriously, and, you know, is an apprenticeship. So as I benefited as a research assistant, I turn around and say, this is a great topic. It's beyond the scope of this work. Why don't you publish it as an article? And they go, huh? Really? Can I do that? I said, absolutely you can, and I'll help you. And I publish it. I don't publish it as my piece. They publish it as their article. Mm. And, you know, I feel that that's the appropriate way to do it. I help them. It's not a co-produced piece of work. It's their work, and I give biofeedback. I can do critical peer review. And that obviously is an amazing thing to have on your CV,
yeah,
that you've got an article in a leading journal. It's usually a short comment or a case note even, but you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think just that skill, and I have to say the satisfaction they have when they can show the evidence of their work in that enduring, it'll be there forever, is a wonderful thing to see. So I know my own excitement on my first article published in 1990. And because it wouldn't have happened but for my then supervisor turning around and saying, oh, this is interesting, but it's not really what I need for this project. Maybe you should publish it as an article and I'll help you. And I've kind of taken that mentorship and continued to do that through the course of my career.
All right, well, we'll leave you with one final question. We talked a lot about the things that students can do right, things that they can do to get ahead. What are some things that you see students, some pitfalls, some common mistakes that students make, and how would you recommend they avoid them?
Peer pressure can be a positive and negative thing. It leads people to make really poor decisions. I think sometimes students that could do honours and do that longer piece of supervised research with an amazing leading scholar, they don't take it because they're told it doesn't really matter, it's not really valued. There's a risk you won't get the grades to get in, so don't even think about it. And look, generations of law students here now have missed the opportunity to have the most amazing experience. We make it tough, I have to say. We're looking at how we market and prepare our students for it. But, you know, knocking on doors and saying, I'm really interested in this, I would like to know how to put together a proposal, I want to do this. We're doing some more things this year to really promote honours opportunities. But I've always been shocked, to be frank, on how few students who can take up the option to do the dissertation, do the long paper, or in the JD, the Independent Research Unit. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the Independent Research Unit, and you know, they think, oh, it would be much better if I do a course on advanced, whatever it is, yeah, corporate, commercial. Whereas you think about it, if you did a topic on advanced corporate law one-on-one with a leading professor in the field who then can write you an amazing reference, not a stock standard reference, but a real reference that goes to you as a scholar, as a person, that's gold. And I don't understand, frankly, why students... Well, I do. It's the power of peer pressure. Not valued, you're wasting a course, you know, better to have that extra elective on advanced complex issues of international ... Mm-hmm. And I actually think that's a mistake. Even more so, the quality of the work gets done in there, the work you produce is probably publishable.
Yeah.
So isn't that a better outcome when you can put that on your CV? So anyway, that's my kind of bugbear as someone who's worked in other places to see how few students are opting for the research paper units.
Mm-hmm. And I do actually have one more question.
You go.
So we did talk about clerkships, and I know a big thing is a lot of people, unfortunately, don't end up in the positions they want. A lot of people don't get the clerkship in the firms that they would like. Sometimes that seems like the end all be all. If you don't get your clerkship, there's no other option. There's nothing else to do. What do you have to say? What is some advice you can give to those people who may not get the position that they want?
It may be a blessing. That may be one thing. If it's really what you want, start somewhere else. Start in a small firm, you know, even government, in whatever role. I've seen students that have done really, you know, they're partners now in top firms, but they, you know, they did a master's, they did a tippy, they were associate to a judge, doesn't matter what level. Then they went to government and they worked in, Canberra is always overlooked in mm-hmm. Sydney. I don't know why. It's the national government, a bit like Washington, you know. Everyone talks about New York, but, you know, don't forget Washington.
Yeah.
So great opportunities there. Your degree is highly valued in government. That will give you scope to go on to do other things. In that particular case, a career at the bar for a while, do that for 5-6 years, and then get recruited into the big firms in your very specialised area. Mm-hmm. So there's you know, again, it's the path less well travelled. It's maybe not as direct, but if you look at the profile of the people who are running the big firms today, largely, they didn't start as trainees. They've been recruited and poached from other firms. So there's more lateral movement now than ever before. So I would say find a great mentor. Learn what you can do. It doesn't matter what firm it's in. Don't be dismayed. Take whatever opportunity you can get.
Yeah, I think the most valuable thing I've learned from doing this podcast is that everybody's path is different.
Yeah.
There's no one way to get into law. There's no one way to get into the job that you'd like. So as long as you just stick at it and find your path, you'll end up there eventually.
Yeah, and look, be open to serendipity. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those random conversations in the corridor can be totally life-changing. And yeah. I've seen that repeatedly through my career. And the conversations years later, 20 years later, someone will come to me and say, Simon, you know that conversation you had with me where you suggested I do this, this, and this? Well, I did, and it changed my life by going off and, you know, studying overseas. And I think I can't even remember the conversation. But, you know, that's the point, being open to opportunity.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the time we have.
All right, Nick.
Thank you so much for being here, Simon. Really appreciate it. Yeah, hopefully I will see you around.
See you around the corridors.
And hopefully one day I can tell you about the life-changing conversation that we had.
Yeah, okay. I look forward to it.
So that's a wrap on the Souls Footnotes Careers series, focusing on the clerkship process. We hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we did. I, for one, really enjoyed interviewing everyone.
Yeah, and I enjoyed mine as well. Of course, thank you so much for Surge for letting us use their fantastic studios. And a big thank you to all of our interviewees, Trishank, Vivian, Bridget, and Simon. I'd like to thank the Footnotes team, Brandon, Jacinda, and Veronica. And most of all, thank you to you, the listener.
We really, really appreciate it. And before you go, don't forget to follow the Sydney University Law Society on Instagram. It is SULS_Sydney. One more time, that is SULS_Sydney. And also, one last time, I'm Tamsin Bellew.
And I'm Nick Leavenworth.
And don't forget to reach out to us if you have any other questions or if you have any suggestions for future episodes.
Yep, we are very happy to help.